I recited a legend concerning these two statues. They had been commissioned in 2270 by Tantus, the Baesian emperor, specifically as companion pieces to the older one of Canoas, which he had just acquired by sacking what was left of Ethras. He had also acquired the quarry whence the marble for the original statue had come, and so he had caused two more great blocks to be extracted from it and shipped to Baas in specially made barges. The finest sculptor of the age had spent 5 years carving these. At the formal unveiling, Tantus had been so taken by the look on Hylaea's face that he had ordered the sculptor to be brought before him and had asked him what it was that Hylaea was about to say. The sculptor had declined to answer the question. Tantus had insisted. The sculptor had pointed out that all of the art and all of the virtue in this statue lay in that very ambiguity. Tantus, fascinated, had asked him a number of questions on that theme, then drew the imperial sword and plunged it into the sculptor's heart, so that he would never be able to undermine his own work of art by answering the question. Later scholarship had cast doubt on this story, as it did on all good stories, but to tell it at this point in the tour was obligatory, and the slines got a kick out of it. In my opinion, these two sculptures were such bald, pro-Hylaea, anti-Deot propaganda that I was almost embarrassed by them. The Deolaters, however, seemed to take precisely the opposite view. Over the course of Apert, Deot's pedestal had become bedizened with so many candles and charms, flowers, stuffed animals, fetishes, phototypes of dead people, and slips of paper, that the one-offs would be cleaning it up for weeks after the gates closed. Deot and Hylaea went out searching for their father and found him lost in contemplation under the tree. Both saw the tablet on which he had recorded his impressions, and both listened to his account. Not long after, Canoas said something so offensive to the king that he was sent into exile, where he soon died. His daughters began telling people different stories. Deot said that Canoas had looked up into the sky and seen the clouds part to give him a vision of a pyramid of light normally concealed from human eyes. He was seeing into another world, a kingdom of heaven where all was bright and perfect. According to her, Canoas drew the conclusion that it was a mistake to worship physical idols such as the one he had been building, for those were only crude effigies of actual gods that lived in another realm, and we ought to worship those gods themselves, not artifacts we made with our own hands. Hylaea said that Canoas had actually been having an upside about geometry. What her sister Deot had misinterpreted as a pyramid in heaven was actually a glimpse of an isosceles triangle. Not a crude and inaccurate representation of one such as Canoas drew on his tablet with ruler and compass, but a pure theoretical object of which one could make absolute statements. The triangles that we drew and measured here in the physical world were all merely more or less faithful representations of perfect triangles that existed in this higher world. We must stop confusing one with the other and lend our minds to the study of pure geometrical objects. You'll notice that there are two exits from this room, I pointed out. One on the left near the statue of Deot, the other on the right near Hylaea. This symbolizes the great forking that now took place between the followers of Deot, whom we call Deolaters, and of Hylaea, who in the early centuries were called Physiologers. If you pass through Deot's door, you'll soon find yourself outside where you can easily find your way back to the Unarian Gate. A lot of our visitors do that because they don't think that anything beyond this point is relevant to them. But if you follow me through the other door, it means you are continuing on the Hylaean Way. And after giving them a few minutes to roam around and take pictures, I went out, leading all but the Deot pilgrims into a gallery lined with pictures and artifacts of the centuries following the death of Canoas. This in turn gave on to the diorama chamber, which was rectangular, with a vaulted ceiling and clerestory windows letting in plenty of light to illuminate the frescoes. The centerpiece was a scale model of the Temple of Orathena. As I explained, this had been founded by Adrakenes, the discoverer of the Adrakenic theorem, which stated that the square of a right triangle's hypotenuse was equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides. To honor this, the floor of the chamber was adorned with numerous visual proofs of the said theorem, any of which you could puzzle out if you stood and stared at it for long enough. We're now in the period from about 2,900 years before the Reconstitution to about -2,600, I said. Adrakenes turned Orithena into a temple devoted to exploration of the HTW, or the Hylaean Theoric World, the plane of existence that had been glimpsed by Canoas. People came from all over. You'll notice that this chamber has a second entrance, leading in from the out-of-doors. This commemorates the fact that many who had taken the other fork and sojourned among the Deolaters came in from the cold, as it were, trying to reconcile their ideas with those of the Orithenans. Some were more successful than others. I looked over at the slines. Back in the rotunda, they had spent some time speculating as to the size of certain parts of the anatomy of Canoas, which were hidden under a fold of his garment, and then gotten into a debate as to which they fancied more, Deot, who was conveniently kneeling, or Hylaea, who was beginning to take her clothes off. In this chamber, they had gathered beneath the most prominent fresco, which depicted a furious, dark-bearded man charging down the steps of the temple, swinging a rake, striking terror in a group of deranged, eye-rolling dice players. It was clear that the slines loved this picture. So far, they had seemed docile enough. So I drew closer to them and explained it. That's Dyax. He was famous for his disciplined thought. He became more and more distressed by the way Orithena was being infiltrated by enthusiasts. Those were people who misunderstood how the Orithenans used numbers. They dreamed up all kinds of crazy number-worshipping stuff. One day Dyax was coming out of the temple after the singing of the anathem, when he saw these guys casting fortunes using dice. He was so furious that he grabbed a rake from a gardener and used it to drive the enthusiasts out of the temple. After that, he ran the place. He coined the term Theorics, and his followers called themselves Theors to distinguish themselves from the enthusiasts. Dyax said something that is still very important to us, which is that you should not believe a thing only because you like to believe it. We call that Dyax's rake, and sometimes we repeat it to ourselves as a reminder not to let subjective emotions cloud our judgment. This explanation was too long for the four slines, who turned their backs to me as soon as I got past the rake fight. I noticed that one of them, the one with his arm in a sling, had a curious bony ridge running up his spine and protruding a few inches above the collar of his jersey. Normally, this was concealed by his trailing burnous, but when he turned away from me, I saw it clearly. It was like a second exoskeletal spine attached to the natural one. At its top was a rectangular tab, smaller than the palm of my hand, bearing a kinogram in which a large stick figure struck a smaller one with his fist. It was one of the spine clamps Quinn had described to me in Orillo. I guessed it had disabled the man's right arm. A fresco on the ceiling at the far end showed the eruption of Ekba and the destruction of the temple. The following series of galleries contained pictures and artifacts from the ensuing Peregrine period, with separate alcoves dedicated to the 40 lesser and the 7 great Peregrines. From there we came out into the great elliptical chamber with its statues and frescoes of the Theoric Golden Age centered on the city-state of Ethras. Protus, gazing up at the clouds painted on the ceiling, anchored one end. His teacher, Telenes, commanded the other, striding across the plain with his interlocutors, variously awed, charmed, chastened, or indignant. The two bringing up the rear had their heads together, conspiring, a foreshadowing of Telenes' trial and ritual execution. A large painting of the city made it easy for me to point out the Deolaters' temples atop its highest hill, where Telenes had been put to death. Its market, the Pericline, wrapped around the hill's base. A flat open area in the center of the Pericline, called the Plain, where geometers would draw figures in the dust or engage in public debate, and the vine-covered bowers around the edges, in whose shade some Theors would teach their fills, from which we got the word suvin, meaning under the vines. As far as the nun was concerned, that one moment made the whole trip worth the trouble. As we worked our way to the farther end, we began seeing Theors standing at the right hands of generals and emperors, which led naturally enough to the last of the great chambers in the Hylaean Way, which was all about the glory that was Baz, its temples, its capital, its walls, roads, and armies, its library, and increasingly as we approached the end, its Ark. After a certain point, it was priests and prelates of the Ark of Baz instead of Theors advising those generals and emperors. Theors had to be sought out as small figures in the deep background, reclining on the steps of the library or going into the capital to spill wise counsel into the dead ears of the high and mighty. Frescoes depicting the sack of Baz and the burning of the library flanked the exit, an incongruously narrow, austere archway that you might miss if it weren't for the statue of Saint Cartes, cradling a few singed and tattered books in one arm, looking back over her shoulder to beckon us toward the exit. This led to a high, stone-walled chamber, devoid of decoration and containing nothing except air. It symbolized the retreat to the Maths and the dawn of the old Mathic Age, generally pegged at -1512. From there, the Hylian Way took a lap around the Unarian cloister and petered out. There was room on the other side where exhibits might one day be added about the rise of the Mystagogues, the Rebirth, the Praxic Age, and possibly even the Harbingers and the Terrible Events. But we had seen all the good stuff, and this was customarily the end of the tour. I thanked them all for coming, invited them to backtrack if they wanted to spend more time with any of what they had seen, reminded them that all were welcome at the 10th night supper, and told them I'd be happy to answer questions. The Slines seemed happy, for now, to savor the pictures of Imperial Bayesian galley combat and library burning. A retired burgher stepped up to thank me for my time. The Suvin kids asked me what sorts of things I had been studying lately. The two visitors who had rushed in at the last minute bided their time as I tried to explain to the kids certain theoretical topics that they had never heard of. After a minute, the nun took pity on me, or possibly on the kids, and hustled them away. The latecomers were a man and a woman, both probably in their fifth decades of life. I did not get the sense that they were having a liaison. Both were attired for commerce, so perhaps they were colleagues in a business. Around each one's neck was a lanyard leading to a flasher of the type used extramuros to demonstrate one's identity and control access to places. Since such things weren't needed here, both of them had tucked their flashers into their breast pockets. They had been appreciative tourists, trailing the group, cocking their heads toward each other to discuss fine details that one or the other had noticed.
"I was intrigued by your remarks about the Daughters of Canoas," the man announced.
His accent marked him as coming from a part of this continent where cities were bigger and closer together than around here, and where a consent might house a dozen or more chapters in contrast to our three. He went on,
"It's just that normally I would expect an avow to emphasize what made them different, but I almost got the idea you were hinting at
And here he stopped, as though groping for a word that was not in the fluckish lexicon. "Common ground," suggested the woman. "A parallel between them." Her accent, as well as the bone structure of her face and the hue of her skin, marked her as coming from the continent that, in this age, was the seat of the secular power. So by this point I had made up a reasonable story in my head about these two. They lived in big cities far away. They worked for the same employer, a business of global scope. They were visiting its local office for some purpose. They had heard it was the last day of Apert, and had decided to spend a couple of hours taking in the sights. Both, I guessed, had spent at least a few years in a Unarian Math when younger. Perhaps the man's orth had grown some rust and he was more comfortable confining the discussion to Fluckish.
"Well, I think many scholars would agree that Deot and Hylaea both say that one should not confuse the symbol with the thing symbolized," I said.
He looked as if I had poked him in the eye.
"What kind of a way to begin a sentence is that? I think many scholars would agree. Why don't you just say what you mean?"
"All right. Deot and Hylaea both say that one should not confuse the symbol with the thing symbolized."
"Well, that's better."
"For Deot, the symbol is an idol. For Hylaea, it's a triangular shape on a tablet. For Deot, the thing symbolized is an actual god in heaven. For Hylaea, it's a pure theoretical triangle in the HTW. So, do you agree that I can speak about that commonality in itself?"
"Yes,"
the man said, reluctantly.
"But an avowed rarely takes an argument that far only to drop it. I keep waiting for you to base some further argument on it, the way they do in the dialogues."
"I take your point clearly," I said.
but I was not in dialogue at the time.
But you are now.
I took this as a joke and chuckled in a way I hoped would seem polite. His face showed a trace of dry amusement, but on the whole, he looked serious. The woman seemed a bit uneasy. But I wasn't then, I said. And then I had a story to tell, and it had to make sense. It makes sense if Dayot and Hylaea took the same idea and mapped it onto different domains. But if I had described them as saying totally contradictory things about their father's vision, it wouldn't have made sense.
It would have made perfect sense if you had made Dayot out to be a lunatic, he demurred.
Well, that's true. Maybe because there were so many Deolaters in the group, I avoided being so blunt.
So you said something you don't actually believe, just to be polite?
It's more a matter of emphasis. I do believe what I said before about the commonality. And so do you, because you agreed with me to that point.
How widespread do you suppose that mentality is within this consent?
Hearing this, the woman looked as if she had got a whiff of something foul. She turned sideways to me and spoke in a subdued voice to the man. Mentality is a pejorative term, isn't it?
All right,
the man said, never taking his eyes off me.
How many here see it your way?
It's a typical Procyon versus Halicarnian dispute, I said. Avowed who follow in the way of Halicarn, Evanedric, and Edhar seek truth and pure theorics. On the Procyon-Fanian side, there is a suspicion of the whole idea of absolute truth and more of a tendency to classify the story of Canoas as a fairy tale. They pay lip service to Hylaea just because of what she symbolizes and because she wasn't as bad as her sister. But I don't think they believe that the HDW is real any more than they believe that there is a heaven.
Whereas Edharians do believe in it?
The woman shot him a look, and he made the following adjustment.
I specify Edharians only because this is the consent of Sant Edhar, after all.
If this man had been one of my fras, I might have spoken more freely now. But he was a secular, strangely well-informed, and he behaved as though he were important. Even so, I might have blurted something out if this had been the first day of Apert. But our gates had been open for 10 days, long enough for me to grow some crude political reflexes. So I answered not for myself, but for my consent. More specifically, for the Edharian order. For all of the Edharian chapters and other consents around the world looked to us as their mother, and had pictures of our minster up in their chapter houses. If you ask an Edharian flat out, he'll be reluctant to admit to it, I began.
Why? Again, this is the consent of Sant Edhar.
It was broken up, I told him. After the third sack, 2/3 of the Edharians were relocated to other consents to make room for a new circle and a reformed old Fa'anite chapter.
The powers that be put a bunch of Procyons in here to keep an eye on you, did they?
This actually caused the woman to reach out and put her hand on his forearm. You seem to be assuming I'm an Edharian myself, I said, but I have not yet made Eligir. I don't even know if the Order of Sant Edhar would accept me.
I hope so, for your sake, he said.
The conversation had become steadily odder from its very beginning and had reached a point where it was difficult for me to see a way forward. Fortunately, the woman got us out of the jam. It's just that with all that's been going on with the Warden of Heaven, we were speculating, as we were on our way here, whether the Avowed were feeling any pressure to change their views. And we wondered if your take on Dayot and Hylaea might have reflected some secular influence. Ah, that's an interesting point, I said. As it happens, I had never heard of the Warden of Heaven until a few days ago, so if my take on Dayot and Hylaea reflects anything at all, it's what I've been thinking about lately for my own reasons.
Very well,
the man said, and turned away. The woman mouthed a thank you at me over her shoulder, and together they strolled off into the cloister. Not long after, the bells began to chime provener. I walked across the Unarian campus, which had been turned inside out. Many of out, as well as some extramuros contract labor, were cleaning the dormitories to make them ready for the crop that would be starting their year tomorrow. For once I reached the minster with plenty of time to spare. I sought out Arcibald and warned him to be on the lookout for those 4 slines. Leo overheard the end of that conversation, and so I had to repeat it as we were getting our robes on. Jezri showed up last, and drunk. His family had thrown a reception for him at their house. When the primate entered the chancel, just before the beginning of the service, he had 2 purple-robed visitors in tow. It was not unusual for hierarchs from other consents to show up in this way. So I didn't think twice about it. The shape of their hats was a little unusual. Archibald was the first to recognize them.
"It appears that we have two honored guests from the Inquisition," he said.
I looked across the chancel and recognized the faces of the man and woman I'd been talking to earlier. I spent the afternoon striping the meadow with rows of tables. Fortunately, Archibald was my partner. He might be a little high-strung in some ways, but beneath the fat, he had the frame of an ox from winding the clock. For 3,000 years, it had been the consent's policy to accept any and all folding chairs and collapsible tables made available to it, and never throw one away. On one and only one occasion, this had turned out to be a wise policy. The millennial apert of 3,000, when 27,500 pilgrims had swarmed in through the gates to enjoy a square meal and see the end of the world. We had folding chairs made of bamboo, machined aluminum, aerospace composites, injection-molded poly, salvaged rebar, hand-carved wood, bent twigs, advanced new matter, tree stumps, lashed sticks, brazed scrap metal, and plated grass. Tabletops could be made of old-growth lumber, particle board, extruded titanium, recycled paper, plate glass, rattan, or substances on whose true nature I did not wish to speculate. Their lengths ranged from 2 to 24 feet, and their weights from that of a dried flower to that of a buffalo.
"You'd think that after all this time someone might have invented, say, the wheel," Archibald mentioned at one point as we were wrestling with a 12-foot-long monster that looked like it might have stopped spears during the old Mathic Age.
Dragging these artifacts up from the cellars and down from the rafters was an almost perfectly stupid task. It was not much more difficult to get Archibald talking about Inquisitors and the Inquisition. The gist of it was that the arrival of two Inquisitors wasn't a big deal at all, unless it was a big deal, in which case it was a really big deal. The Inquisition long ago had become a relatively non-psychotic, even bureaucratized process. This was evidenced by the fact that we saw the Warden Regulant and her officers all the time, even when we weren't in trouble. Though they reported to the Primate, they were technically a branch of the Inquisition. They even had the power to depose a Primate in certain circumstances. Archibald, warming to the task, here threw in some precedents of yore involving insane or criminal Primates. Consistent standards had to be maintained across all the world's consents, or else the reconstitution would be null and void. And how could that be achieved unless there existed this elite class of hierarchs, typically Wardens Regulant, who had doled out so much penance to their long-suffering fras and sewers that they'd been noticed and promoted, who traveled from consent to poke around and keep an eye on things? It happened all the time. I just hadn't noticed it until now. "I'm a little rattled by something that happened just before Provenor," I told him. We were out in the meadow, working on our second acre of tables. Sewers and younger fras were scurrying around in our wake, lining the tables with chairs, covering them with paper. Older and wiser fras were hauling on lines, causing a framework of almost weightless struts to rise up above our heads. Later, these would support a canopy. In an open-air kitchen in the center of the meadow, older sewers were trying to kill us with the fragrance of dishes that were many hours away from being served. Archibald and I had been trying for 10 minutes to defeat the latching mechanism on the legs of an especially over-designed table, military surplus from a 5th-century world war. Certain levers and buttons had to be depressed in the right sequence or the legs would not deploy. A dark brown leaf, folded many times, had been wedged into the undercarriage. Helpful instructions written in the year 940 by one Fra Bolo, who had succeeded in getting the table open and wanted to brag about it to generations of unborn avowed. But he used incredibly recondite terminology to denote the different parts of the table, and the leaf had been attacked by mice. At a moment when we were about to lose our tempers, throw the table off the presidium, consign Fra Bolo's useless instructions to the fires of hell, and run out the decade gate in search of strong drink, Fra Archibald and I agreed to sit down for a moment and take a break. That was when I told Archibald about my conversation with Varax and O'Nally, as the male and female inquisitors were called, according to the grapevine.
Inquisitors in disguise. I don't think I've heard of that,
Archibald said. Gazing worriedly at the look on my face, he added,
Which means nothing. It is selection bias. Inquisitors who can't be distinguished from the general populace would, of course, go unnoticed and unremarked on.
Somehow I didn't find that very comforting.
They have to move about somehow, Archibald insisted.
It never occurred to me to wonder how, exactly. They can't very well have their own special aircraft and trains, can they?
Much more sensible for them to put on normal clothing and buy a ticket just like anyone else.
I would guess that they happened to come in from the aerodrome just as your tour was beginning, and decided on the spur of the moment to tag along so that they could view the statues in the rotunda, which anyone would want to see.
Your words make sense, but I still feel burned.
Burned?
Yeah. That Varex tricked me into saying things I'd never have said to an Inquisitor.
Then why on earth did you say them to a total stranger? This wasn't helpful. I threw him a look.
What did you say that was so bad? He tried.
Nothing, I concluded, after I had thought about it for a while. I mean, I probably sounded very HTW, very Adharian. If Varax is a Prokian, he hates me now.
But that is still within normal limits. There are whole orders that have prospered for thousands of years saying much more ridiculous things without running afoul of the Inquisition.
I know that, I said. Looking across the meadow, I happened to see Corlandon and several others of the new circle getting in position to rehearse a carol that they would sing tonight. From 100 feet away, I could see them grinning and exchanging handshakes. I could smell their confidence as if I were a dog. I wanted to be like that. Not like the crusty Adharian theoricians carrying on bitter debates about the vector sums on the vertices of the canopy struts.
When I say burned, maybe what I'm getting at is that I burned my bridge. What I said to Varax is going to get repeated to Sura Trestinus and then filter down to the rest of her lot.
You're afraid the new circle won't want you for Eliger?
That is correct.
You can avoid the stink, then. Better for you.
What stink, Archibald?
The stink that's going to permeate this place when most of our crop join the Adharians. The new circle and the reformed old Fanians are going to be left with floor sweepings.
Trying to seem casual, I looked around to be sure that we were not in earshot of any of the Fids Archibald considered to be floor sweepings. But the only person nearby was the primeval Grand Fra Mentaxon, shuffling around, waiting for a purpose, but too proud to ask for one. I approached him with the gnawed table-opening codex of Fra Bolo and asked him to translate it. He couldn't have been more ready. Archibald and I left him to it and trudged back toward the minster for the next table.
What makes you think that's going to happen? I said.
Orlo has been talking to many of us, not just you, Archibald said.
Recruiting us?
Corlandon recruits, which is why we don't trust him. Orlo simply talks and lets us draw our own conclusions.
Bullshit. 1. In Fleckish of the late Praxic Age and early Reconstitution, a derogatory term for false speech in general, especially knowing and deliberate falsehood or obfuscation. 2. In Orth, a more technical and clinical term denoting speech, typically but not necessarily commercial or political, that employs euphemism, convenient vagueness, numbing repetition, and other such rhetorical subterfuges to create the impression that something has been said. 3. According to the Knights of Sant Helikarn, a radical order of the 2nd millennium AR, all speech and writings of the ancient Sphenix, the mystagogues of the old Mathic Age, Praxic Age commercial and political institutions, and, since the Reconstitution, anyone they deemed to have been infected by Procyon thinking. Their frequent and loud use of this word to interrupt lectures, dialogues, private conversations, etc., exacerbated the divide between Procyon and Helikarnian orders that characterized the Mathic world in the years leading up to the Third Sack. Shortly before the Third Sack, all of the Knights of Sant Helikarn were thrown back, so little more is known about them. Their frequent appearance in secular entertainments results from confusion between them and the Encanters. Usage note. In the Mathic world, if the word is suddenly shouted out in a chalk hall or refectory, it brings to mind the events associated with Sense 3 and is therefore to be avoided. Spoken in a moderate tone of voice, it takes on Sense 2, which long ago lost any vulgar connotations it may once have had. In the Seculum, it is easily confused with Sense 1 and deemed a vulgarity or even an obscenity. It is inherent in the mentality of extramuros bullshit talkers that they are more prone than anyone else to taking offense or pretending to when their bullshit is pointed out to them. This places the Mathic observer in a nearly impossible position. One is forced either to use this, quote, offensive, unquote, word and be deemed a disagreeable person and as such excluded from polite discourse, or to say the same thing in a different way, which means becoming a purveyor of bullshit oneself and thereby lending strength to what one is trying to attack. The latter quality probably explains the uncanny stability and resiliency of bullshit. Resolving this dilemma is beyond the scope of this dictionary and is probably best left to hierarchs who make it their business to interact with the Seculum. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Somehow that canopy got raised. The struts were new matter dating back to the founding of the consent. As dusk fell, they began to emit a soft light that came from all directions and made even Fromm and Taxon look healthy. Beneath it, 1,200 visitors, 300 decenarians, and 500 unarians celebrated 10th night. This had originated as a harvest festival, coinciding with the end of the calendar year. Thanks to some adroit sequence writing that had been done before the second sack, we had a few crops that could grow almost year-round. In our greenhouses, we could cultivate less hardy plants in midwinter. But that stuff wasn't glorious in the way that tangle food was at this time of the year. The tangle had been invented way back before Canoas, by people who lived on the opposite side of the world from Ethros and Baz. Cob grew straight up out of the ground to the height of a man's head and bore rich heads of party-colored kernels late in the summer. In the meantime, it served as a trellis for climbing vines of pod beans that gave us protein while fixing nitrogen in the soil to nourish the cob. In the web that the pod bean vines spun among the cob stalks, three other kinds of vegetables grew. Highest from the ground, where bugs couldn't get to them, red, yellow, and orange tomates to give us vitamins and flavor our salads, stews, and sauces. Snaking along the ground, gourds of many varieties. In the middle, hollow pepper pods. Tubers of two kinds grew beneath the ground, and leaf vegetables gathered whatever light remained. The original ancient tangle had comprised 8 plants, and the people who cultivated them had, over thousands of years, bred them to be as efficient as they could be without actually reaching in and tinkering with their sequences. Ours were more efficient yet, and we had added 4 more types of plants, 2 of which had no purpose other than to replenish the soil. At this time of year, the tangles we've been cultivating since thaw were in their glory and sported a variety of color and flavor that couldn't be had extramuros. That's why Appert took place now. It was a way for those inside the math to share their good fortune with their neighbors' extramuros, as well as to relieve them of any babies not likely to survive the winter. I saved seats for Cord and her boyfriend, Rosk. Cord also brought with her a cousin of ours, Daff, a boy of 15. I remembered him vaguely. He'd been the kind of youngster who was always being rushed to Physicians' Commons for repair of astonishing traumas. Somehow he'd survived, and even put on passable clothing for the event. His dents and scars were hidden beneath a mess of curly brown hair. Arcibald made sure he was seated across from the exquisite Cord. He didn't appear to understand the significance of Rosk. Jesri caused his entire family to sit at the next table, which placed him back to back with me. Then Jesri flagged down Orlo and persuaded him to sit in our cluster. Orlo attracted Leo and several other lonely wanderers who proceeded to fill out our table. Death was the kind of sweet, untroubled soul who could ask very basic questions with no trace of embarrassment. I tried to answer them in the same spirit. "You know I'm a slime cousin," I said. "So the difference between slimes and us is not that we're smarter. That is demonstrably not the case." This topic had come up after people had been eating, drinking, talking, and singing old carols just long enough to make it obvious that there really were no differences. Death, who had come through his early mishaps with his good sense intact, had been looking about and taking note of this. I could read it on his face. And so he had raised the question of why bother to put up walls, to have an extramuros and an intramuros. Orlo had caught wind of this and turned around to get a look at Death.
"It would be easier for you to understand if you could see one of the pinprick maths," he said.
"Pinprick maths?"
"Some are no more than a one-room apartment with an electrical clock hanging on the wall and a well-stocked bookcase. One of out lives there alone, with no spiele, no jija. Perhaps every few years an inquisitor comes round and pokes his head in the door just to see that all is well."
"What's the point of that?" Death asked.
"That is precisely the question I am asking you to think about," Orlo said, and turned back round to resume a conversation with Jessery's father.
Death threw up his hands. Archibald and I laughed, but not at his expense.
"That's how Pa Orlo does his dirty work," I told him.
"Tonight, instead of sleeping, you'll lie awake wondering what he meant," Archibald said.
"Well, aren't you guys going to help me? I'm not a fra," Death pleaded.
"What would motivate someone to sit alone in a one-room apartment reading and thinking?" Archibald asked. "What would have to be true of a person for them to consider that a life well spent?"
"I don't know. Maybe they're really shy, scared of open spaces?"
"Agoraphobia is not the correct answer," Archibald said, a little huffy.
"What if the places you went and the things you encountered in your work were more interesting than what was available in the physical world around you?" I tried.
"Okay.
You might say that the difference between us and you is that we have been infected by a vision of another world."
I'd been about to say a greater or a higher, but settled for another.
"I don't like the infection metaphor," Archibald started to say in Orth.
I need him under the table.
"You mean like a different planet?" Death asked.
"Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it," I said. "Most of us don't think it's another planet in the sense of a speculative fiction spiele. Maybe it's the future of this world. Maybe it's an alternate universe we can't get to. Maybe it's nothing but a fantasy. But at any rate, it lives in our souls and we can't help striving toward it."
"What's that world like?" Death asked.
Behind me, a jingle began to play from someone's jija. It wasn't that loud, but something about it made my brain lock up.
"For one thing, it doesn't have any of those," I told Death.
After the jija had been singing for a little while, I turned around. Everyone in a 20-foot radius was staring at Jessery's older brother, who was slapping himself all over trying to determine which of the pockets in his suit contained the jija. Finally, he extracted it and silenced it. He stood up, as if he had not drawn enough attention to himself, and bellowed his own name.
"Yes, Dr. Grain,"
he went on, staring into the distance like a holy man.
I see. Can they infest humans as well?"
"Really?"
"I was only joking. Well, how would we be able to tell if that had happened?"
People turned back to their meals, but conversations were slow to restart because of sporadic incursions from Jessery's brother. Archibald cleared his throat, as only Archibald could. It sounded like the end of the world.
"The primate's about to speak."
I turned around and looked at Jessery, who had realized the same thing and was waving his arms at his brother, who stared right through him. He was negotiating a bulk rate on biopsies. He was a very tough negotiator. Women in the party, sisters and sisters-in-law of Jessery, had begun to feel ashamed and to tug at the man's elbows. He spun around and stalked away from us.
"Excuse me, doctor, I didn't catch that last part. Something about the larvae?"
But in his defense, as I looked around, I could see that he was only one of many who were using G-Jaws for one purpose or another. Statho had already addressed us twice. The first time had been ostensibly to greet everyone, but really to nag us into taking our seats. The second time had been to intone the invocation, which had been written by Dyax himself while the rake blisters were still fresh on his hands. If you could understand Proto-Orth, and if you happened to be a mushy-headed, number-worshipping enthusiast, the invocation would make you feel distinctly unwelcome. Everyone else just thought it added a touch of class to the proceedings. Now he told us we were going to be entertained by a contingent of Edharians. Statho's grasp of Fluckish was weak. The way he phrased it, he was commanding us to be entertained. This made laughter run through the crowd, which left him nonplussed and asking the inquisitors, who were flanking him at the high table, for explanations. Three fras and two sewers sang a five-part motet, while 12 others milled around in front of them. Actually, they weren't milling, it just looked that way from where we sat. Each one of them represented an upper or lower index in a theoretical equation involving certain tensors and a metric. As they moved to and fro, crossing over one another's paths and exchanging places while traversing in front of the high table, they were acting out a calculation involving the curvature of a four-dimensional manifold involving various steps of symmetrization, anti-symmetrization, and raising and lowering of indices. Seen from above by someone who didn't know any theorics, it would have looked like a country dance. The music was lovely, even if it was interrupted every few seconds by the warbling of gee-jaws. Then we ate and drank more. Then the new circle fras sang their piece, which was much better received than the tensor dance. Then we ate and drank more. Statho made it all tick along, like Cord running her five-axis mill. We weren't used to seeing him do a lot of work, but he was earning his beer this evening. To the visitors, this was just a free feed with weird entertainment. But in truth, it was a ritual as old and as important as Provener. And so there were certain boxes that had to be checked if we were to get out of it without drawing a rebuke from the Inquisition. And Statho was the kind who would have done it the right way, even if Varax and O'Nally hadn't been sitting there asking him to pass the salt. Fra Haligastrium was introduced to say a few words on behalf of the Edharian chapter. He tried to talk about what I had mentioned to Dath earlier and bungled it even worse. He was the funniest man in the world if you just walked up to him and asked him a question, but he was helpless when given the opportunity to prepare, and the sporadic alarms of the gee-jaws shattered his concentration and reduced his talk to a heap of shards. The only shard that lodged in my memory was his concluding line,
"If this all seems ambiguous, that's because it is, and if that troubles you, you'd hate it here. But if it gives you a feeling of relief, then you are in the right place and might consider staying."
Next up was Corlandon for the new circled chapter.
"I've been with my family the last 10 days, he announced, and smiled over at a table of burghers who smiled back at him. "They were kind enough to organize a family reunion during Appert. All of them have busy lives out there, just as I do in here, but for these days we suspended our routines, our careers, and our other commitments so that we could be together." "Myself, I've been out watching Spieleys," Orlo remarked. Only about 5 of us could hear him. "Ones with plenty of explosions. Some are quite enjoyable."
Corlandon continued.
"Making dinner, normally a routine chore we perform to avoid starvation, became something altogether different. The pattern of cuts my Aunt Prin made in the top crust of a pie was not just a system of vents to relieve internal pressure, but a sort of ritual going back who knows how many generations. An invocation, if you will, of her ancestors who did it the same way. The conversations we had about, say, when Grandpa Mert fell off of his porch roof while cleaning the gutters were not just debriefings about the hazards of home renovation, but celebrations, full of laughter, tears, and sometimes laughter and tears at the same time, of how much we loved each other. So you could say that nothing was about what it superficially seemed to be about, which in another context might make it sound all just a bit sinister. But obviously it was nothing of the kind. We all got it. You'd have gotten it too. And that's a lot like what we Fras and Sewers do in this consent all the time. Thank you."
And Corlandon sat down. Slightly indignant murmuring from Avout, not at all certain that they agreed with him, was drowned out by applause from the majority of visitors. Poor Sewer Franling had to get up next and say a few words for the reformed old Fanians, but she could have been reading from an economic database for all anyone cared. Most of the Avout were peeved by Corlandon's eloquence or glibness, and Orlo was among them. But to his credit,
he pointed out that Corlandon had smoothed over an awkward moment and probably won us some sympathy extramuros.
"How do you know when someone is really glib?" Jezri muttered to me.
"I'll bite. How?"
"It doesn't cross your mind that he's glib until someone older and wiser points it out, and then your face turns hot with shame."
More music then, as most of us avowed got up to clear plates and fetch dessert. The entertainment, which earlier had been so intimidating, had become a little easier to enjoy. Many of the carols, traditionally played over loudspeakers in stores and elevators at this time of year, were derived from liturgical music that had originated in the Maths and filtered out at Appert. And so many of the visitors were pleasantly surprised to hear familiar melodies spilling from the lips of these bolt-wrapped weirdos. Dessert was sheet cakes baked and served in broad trays. One of them ended up in front of Arcibald. Not a coincidence. He picked up the spatula that had arrived with it, a flat metal blade about the size of the palm of a child's hand. Just before he plunged it into the cake, I had an idea and stopped him.
"Let's have Death do it," I said.
"As hosts, it is our duty to serve," Arcibald demurred.
"Then you can serve. But I want Death to do the cutting," I insisted. I wrenched the spatula from Arcibald's grip and handed it across to Death, who took it a little uncertainly. I then talked him through cutting the cake, but I had him go about it in a very specific way. Working through the steps of an old geometry proof that Orlo had taught me when I had been a brand new Fid, up all night crying because I missed my old life. This took a little while, but when all was said and done, it was clear from the look on Death's face that he understood it, and I was able to tell him, "Congratulations! You've just worked out a geometric proof that is thousands of years old."
They had sheet cakes back then?
No. But they had land and other things they needed to measure, and the same trick works for those things too.
"Uh-huh,"
Death said, gobbling a vertex from his serving.
"You say uh-huh like it is not a big deal, but it is a big deal to us," I said.
"Why should a proof that works for sheet cake work as well for a plot of land? Cake and land are different things." We had gone a little over the head of Death, who just wanted to eat his cake, but Cord saw it.
"I guess I have an unfair advantage here since I spend so much time thinking about geometry in my work, but the answer is that geometry is, well, geometry. It's pure. It doesn't matter what you're applying it to.
And it turns out that the same is true for other kinds of theorics besides geometry," I said.
"You can prove something. Later, the same thing might be proved in a totally different way, but you always end up with the same answer. No matter who is discussing these proofs and what age, whether they are speaking of sheet cake or pasture land, they always arrive at the same answer. These truths seem to come out of another world or plane of existence. It's hard not to believe that this other world really exists in some sense, not just in our imaginations. And we would like to go there."
"Preferably without having to die first," Arcibald put in.
"When I'm cutting apart, sometimes I get obsessed with it," Cord said. "I lie awake in my bed, thinking about its shape. Is that perhaps related to how you all feel about what you study?"
"Why not? You're carrying this geometry around in your head that fascinates you. Some would say it's only a pattern of neurons firing in your brain, but it has an independent reality. And for you, thinking about that reality is an interesting and rewarding way to spend your life."
Rosk was a manual therapist.
He put his hands on people to fix them.
"I've been working on someone who has a pinched nerve because he has lousy posture," he said. "I was discussing it with my teacher over the G-jaw, no pictures, just our voices. We had this long talk about this nerve and the muscles and ligaments around it and how I should manipulate them to help alleviate the problem, and suddenly I just flashed on how weird the whole thing was. Two of us both relating to this image, this model of another person's body that was in his mind and in my mind, but also seemingly in a third place," I suggested. "A shared place."
"Well, that's what it felt like. It freaked me out for a little while, but then I put it out of my mind because I thought I was just being weird.
Well, it's been freaking people out since Canoas, and this is like an asylum for people who can't stop thinking about it," I said. "It's not for everyone, but it's harmless."
"Since the third sack, anyway," Rosk said.
That he said it so innocently made it 10 times as rude as it was to begin with. I saw Cord's face flush, and guessed she'd probably have words with him after dinner. It was anyone's guess whether he'd ever really understood why it was such an abhorrent thing to say. People were shushing us because we had reached that part of the aught where the newcomers were presented at the high table. 8 foundlings had been collected. 1 was sickly and would stay in the Unarian Math, where it would be easier for the physicians to keep an eye on her. 2 of them still had the stumps of their umbilical cords attached, which meant that they were destined for the Millenarian Math. By way of a brief sojourn among the Hundreders, we would pass them along via our upper labyrinth. The remaining 5 were a little bit older, and so would be passed to the Hundreders. 36 youngsters were to be collected. 17 of these, including Barb, would come directly to our math. The others would stay with the one-offs, at least at first. With any luck, some of them might graduate to our math later. 12 of the one-offs had decided to graduate to our math. 9 more had arrived from another, smaller consent in the mountains that acted as a feeder to ours. All of these were brought up before the high table, welcomed and applauded. Tomorrow, after the gate closed, we would celebrate their arrival in a much more tedious ceremony. Tonight was the time for the Extramuros authorities to supply their own special brand of tedium. By ancient tradition, the highest-ranking Pangendrum present at this dinner was supposed to stand up and formally hand the newcomers over to us. At that moment, they passed out of secular and into mathic jurisdiction. We became responsible for housing them and feeding them, caring for them when they ailed, burying them when they died, and punishing them when they misbehaved. It was as if they ceased in this moment to be citizens of one country and became citizens of another. It was, in other words, a big deal from a legal standpoint, and it had to be solemnized by the speaking of certain oaths and the ringing of a bell. And there was an almost as ancient tradition that the official in question would use it as an excuse to deliver some remarks. This turned out to be the rope-draped oddity who had appeared at the Decade Gate with his contingent on the first morning of Appert. After thanking everyone from God on down and then back up to God again, and then, as a precaution, tacking on a blanket thank you for any persons or supernatural beings he had left out, he began,
"Even those of you who live at Sant Edhar must be aware by now that the extraordinary reconfiguration of prefectural boundaries mandated by the 11th Circle of Archmagistrates has literally transformed the political landscape. The plenary council of the recovered satrapies has passed through a tipping point of no return, placing 5 of the 8 tetrarchies within the grasp of a new generation of leaders who, I can promise you, will be far more sensitive than their predecessors to the values and priorities of new counter-Bayesian constituencies, and our many friends who may belong to other arcs, or even to no arc at all, but who share our concerns. If there are 8 of them, why are they called tetrarchs?" Orlo demanded, drawing an exasperated look from Jezri's father, who had been listening intently. He was taking notes.
"There were 4 of them originally, and the name stuck," Arcibald said.
Jessery's father seemed to relax a bit, thinking that the interruption was over. But we were just beginning.
"What's a new counter-Bayesian?" Leo wanted to know.
Jessery's brother shushed him. To my surprise, Jessery rose to Leo's defense.
"We didn't tell you to shut up when you were bellowing about your infestation."
"Yes, you did."
"I'll bet it's a euphemism for one of those Warden of Heaven nut jobs," I said to Leo. This brought a cataract of shushing down on me.
Jezri's father sighed as if he could thereby rise above all of this and cupped a hand to his ear, but it was too late. We had planted a branching tree of arguments and recriminations. The mayor was going on and on about the beauty of our clock, the majesty of our minster, and the magnificent singing of the frogs and sewers. At no point did he say anything that was not as sugary as words could be, and yet the feeling I got was one of foreboding, as if he were urging all of his constituents to mass before our gates with bottles of gasoline. The argument between Jezri and his brother decayed into sporadic sniper fire across the table, suppressed by glares and arm squeezings from exasperated females who had wordlessly squared up into a peacekeeping force. Jessery's brother had decided that with our hair-splitting debates about how many tetrarchs there were,
We had shown ourselves to be a lot of insignificant pedants. Jessery informed him that this was an iconography that dated back to before the founding of the city-state of Ethras. In some eerily quiet way that he must have learned from a book of Vale lore, Leo had vanished. Strangely, for one who studied fighting so much, he hated conflict. I waited until the bell had rung to induct the newcomers, then excused myself and walked out during the standing ovation. I felt like getting some fresh air. By tradition, the revelry would wind down and the cleanup gather momentum until the gates closed at dawn, so it was unlikely I'd miss much. The meadow was lit partly by the harvest moon and partly by light diffusing through the skirts of the great canopy, which, when I turned around to look back on it, looked like an enormous straw-colored moon half-sunk into a dark sea. Leo was silhouetted against it. He was moving in an odd, dance-like fashion, which for him was hardly unusual. One end of his bolt was modesty-wrapped, but the other was all over the place, flinging out like a bucket of suds, then wafting down for a few moments, only to be snapped back and regathered. The same thing he'd been practicing on the statue of Saint Froga. It was strangely fascinating to watch. I was not his only spectator. A few visitors had gathered around him. Bulky men, four of them, all wearing the same color. Numbers on their backs. Leo's bolt slapped down on top of number 86 and draped him, making him look like a ghost. The lower part was all in a thrash as he flailed his arms to throw it off. His head was a stationary knob at the top, hence a fine target for the ball of Leo's foot, which was delivered in a perfectly executed flying kick. I started running toward them. 86 went down backwards. Leo's momentum carried him to the same place. He used 86's torso to cushion his landing and rolled off smartly, staying low like a spider and snapping his bolt free. 79 was coming in high. Leo spun clear of the line of attack and in so doing got his bolt around 79's knees. Then he stood up, bringing 79's knees with him. 79's face dove at the ground and he didn't get his arms up, excuse me, down, fast enough to avoid getting a mouthful of turf. For just a moment after Leo spiraled his bolt loose, 79 remained poised upside down with his legs splayed. Leo absent-mindedly rammed his elbow down into the V as he turned to see who was next. Answer? Number 23, running right at him. Leo turned and ran away, but not very fast. 23 gained on him. It was his fate to step on Leo's bolt, which was dragging behind Leo on the grass. This demolished his gait, which had been clumsy to begin with. Leo sensed it, as how could he not, since the other end of that bolt was lashed around his crotch. He whirled and yanked. 23 somehow remained on his feet, but the price he paid for doing so was that he ended up staggering, bent forward at the waist, leading with his head. Leo stepped into position and used 23's momentum to flip him over his hip. 23 didn't know how to fall. He came down hard on his back. I knew what was coming next. Leo would follow with a death blow to the exposed throat. And that is just what he did. But he pulled it, as he always had with me, and refrained from staving in the man's windpipe. One remained. And I do mean one, for he had a large numeral one on his back. This was the man with his arm in a sling. With his good arm, he had been rummaging through the pockets of the fallen 86. He found what he had been looking for and stood up, holding something that I was pretty sure was a gun. His spine clamp exploded in light, flashing alternately red and blue. He uttered a common profanity. He dropped the gun and collapsed. Every muscle in his body had lost tone in the same instant, jammed by signals from the clamp. All four of the attackers were down now, and the meadow was quiet, except for the plaintive warbling of their gee-jaws. A solitary person somewhere nearby began clapping. I assumed it was a slime who had had too much to drink, but looking toward the sound, I was surprised to see a hooded figure in a bolt. He kept shouting an ancient Orth word that meant, "Hail, huzzah, well done." Stalking toward this fraw, I shouted, "I hope you're stinking drunk, because if not, you're an idiot. He could have gotten killed. And even if you really are that big of a jerk, don't you know there's a couple of inquisitors skulking around?"
"It's okay,"
One of them skulked out to get away from that idiotic speech, the Fraa said.
He pulled back his hood to reveal that he was Varax of the Inquisition. I can't guess what my face looked like, but I can tell you that the sight of it was the most entertaining thing Varax had seen in a long time. He tried not to show it too much.
It never ceases to amaze me what people think of us and why we're here, he said. Will you please forget about this? It is nothing.
He looked up at the top of the Presidium.
Larger matters are at stake than whether a young Fraa at the remote hermitage of St. Edhar practices his vlore on some local runagates. For God's sake, he continued,
which sounded funny to me since few of us believed in God, and he didn't seem like one of them. But maybe it was just an oath used by cosmopolitan people in the sorts of places where our consent was thought of as a remote hermitage.
For God's sake, raise your sights. Think bigger, the way you were doing this morning, the way your friend there does when he decides to tackle four larger men.
And with that, Varax drew his hood back over his head and walked back toward the canopy. He passed the Warden Fendant and the Warden Regulant hurrying the other way. The two of them parted and stood aside to let him pass. Each nodded and uttered some term of respect that no one had ever bothered to teach me. Both of the wardens were looking rather tightly wound. In ordinal time, the boundary between their jurisdictions was clear. It was the top of the wall. During Apert, things became complicated as the wall ceased to exist for 10 days. Sir Trustinus was for throwing the book at Leo. Fra Degalos was satisfied with how things had come out, with a few quibbles. When Leo had noticed the forced lines sneaking out the back, he ought to have alerted someone instead of going out to confront them himself.
Well, is that an offense or isn't it? Demanded Sir Trustinus.
It is an overlookable offense as far as I am concerned, said Degalos, but I'm not the Warden Regulant.
Well, I am, said Sir Trustinus unnecessarily.
And for one of our Fraas to be brawling during Apert when he's supposed to be welcoming newcomers and bussing tables strikes me as something that could even lead to being thrown back.
This was such an outrageous thing to say that I spoke immediately, as if Leo's impulsiveness had jumped like a spark into my head.
If I were you, I'd run that by Inquisitor Varax before taking it any further, I said.
Trestinus turned and looked at me, head to toe, as if she had never seen me before. And perhaps she hadn't.
The amount of private time you are spending with our honored guests is remarkable, extraordinary.
And accidental, I promise you.
But Sir Trustinus was, I realized too late, jealous of me for this. Almost as if she pined to be in a liaison with Varax and O'Nally, but they had a crush on me. And she had never believed that my encounters with them had been mere accidents. You didn't get to be Warden Regulant by believing such things.
It is obvious that you have no conception of the power that the Inquisition may wield over us.
Not true. They may put the consent on probation for up to 100 years, during which time our diet will be restricted to the basics, nutritional but not so interesting. If we haven't mended our ways after a century, they can come in and clean the place out, top to bottom. And they have the power to fire any hierarch and replace him or her, with, a new one of their choosing. I was faltering because my brain, too late, was working through the implications. I had only been spewing back what Archibald had told me earlier in the day, but to Trestinus it would, of course, sound like a taunt.
Maybe you think that St. Edhar's current hierarchs are not handling their responsibilities well,
Sir Trestinus proposed, too calmly.
Perhaps Degalos, or Statho, or I ought to be replaced.
I have never thought anything of the sort, I said,
and bit my tongue before I could add, until now.
Then why all of these secret assignations with the Inquisitors? You are the only non-hierarch who has spoken to them at all, and now you have done so twice, both times under circumstances that were extraordinarily private.
This is crazy, I said. This is crazy.
More is at stake than a boy of your age can comprehend. Your naivete, combined with your refusal to admit just how naive you are, imposes risks on us all. I am throwing the book at you.
No,
I couldn't believe it. Chapters 1 through, 5.
You have got to be kidding.
I believe you know what to do, she said, and looked across the meadow to the minster.
Fine. Fine, chapters 1 through 5, I repeated, and turned toward the canopy.
Halt,
Sewer Trustiness said. I halted.
The minster is that way, she said, sounding amused. You seem to be going the wrong direction.
My Sib and my cousin are in there. I just need to go and explain to them that I have to leave.
The minster, she repeated, is in that direction.
I can't do 5 chapters before sunrise, I pointed out. The gates are going to be closed when I come out of that cell. I have to say goodbye to my family.
Have to? Curious choice of words. Let me bring you up to date on semantics. Since you who worship at Hylaea's feet are so keen on such things, you have to go to the minster. You want to say goodbye to your family. The whole point of being a Fra is to be free of those wants that enslave people who live extramuros. I am doing you the favor of forcing you to make a choice now, in this instant. If you want to see your family so badly, go see them, and keep on walking right out the gate and don't ever come back. If you will remain here, you have to walk straight to the minster, now. I looked for Leo, hoping he might convey a message to Cord and Dath, but he was some distance away now, recounting the fight to Degelos. And anyway, I didn't want to give Sewer Trustiness the additional pleasure of telling me I couldn't. So I turned my back on what remained of my family and started walking toward the minster.